And we are celebrating now 50 years next year for the Israeli occupation. And it's a nice reminder for all of us that this occupation is here to stay, that nobody in Israel has a real intention to put an end to it, that this temporary phenomena became reality and for many, many years. If there was hope once, which I didn't share, that Israel is about to give up the occupation, after 50 years, one can realize that Israel has no intention, and may I say, never had an intention, to put an end to the occupation.
That's Gideon Levy, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Bar-Samyan. This edition of AR features Gideon Levy on the never-ending occupation, Palestine. Israeli General and later Prime Minister Ariel Sharon said of the Palestinians, "We'll make a pastrami sandwich out of them. We'll insert a strip of Jewish settlements in between the Palestinians and then another strip of Jewish settlements right across the West Bank, so that in 25 years' time, neither the United Nations nor the United States, nobody, will be able to tear it apart." Sharon said that in 1973. Today, there are more than 600,000 settlers in the occupied territories. They are facts on the ground, as the Israelis like to say. All of the settlements are outside Israel's internationally recognized borders and are unambiguously illegal under international law. Thomas Friedman in the New York Times says the settlements constitute a tacit annexation of the West Bank, and then he adds, and is not winning Israel friends in Europe or America. To talk about this issue is Gideon Levy. He was born and lives in Tel Aviv. He's a columnist and member of the editorial board of Haaretz, Israel's oldest daily newspaper, where he has covered the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for more than 30 years. He has received several awards for his work, including the Olaf Palme Prize for his courageous and indefatigable fight against occupation and violence, and for a future Middle East characterized by peaceful coexistence and equality for all. He spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico, at a Lenin Foundation event. And now, Gideon Levy.
I would start with the subject that I know the least, and I understand the least, and this is a few sentences about myself. I was born in Tel Aviv. I spent all my life in Israel. I never left Israel. My parents left Europe in 1939, really in the last moment. They were refugees. I mean, at least my father, I perceive him as a refugee for the rest of his life. He never really found his place in Israel, even though he loved the life there and everything. I was a typical product of Israeli education system, of the Israeli media. I was brought up to think that we Jews are always right and the Arabs are always wrong, that they want to throw us to the ocean, that they are the Goliath and we are the little David, the little weak David, and we live under a permanent existential threat. I believed in all this. I believed even in 67 when the Six-Day War took place almost 50 years ago. I remember my first tour with my parents to the occupied territories. I happened to have then, I was lucky enough to have then a girlfriend. I was 14 then. A girlfriend whose father was a colonel in the army, so we got the permission to go the day after the war with my parents. I remember how excited I was about the liberation of the holy places. I don't remember one Palestinian. I didn't see them. I was just in this part of this nationalistic religious orgy of Israel liberating its land, the Jewish people gets back to its place. And it took me many, many more years in which I did some sins. I served in the Israeli army, but I did something which is much worse than this. I worked for 4 years for the late Shimon Peres, back in the late 70s and beginning of the 80s, and still I was deeply convinced that basically justice is with us, that we are right, and the Palestinians, the Arabs, are always wrong. And it's happened only in the late 80s when accidentally I started to travel to the occupied territories, incidentally, and I realized gradually two things, that that's the biggest drama of Israel after its establishment, and there is almost no one to tell the story. The biggest drama of our life is taking place in a dark backyard, half an hour away from our homes. Most of the Israelis know nothing about it and don't want to know anything about it. The media is totally covering it up. Politicians are happy to cover it up. Military organizations are happy to cover it up. This rare coalition that nobody wants to know and nobody wants to tell. And then I realized gradually what a crime is taking place there on a daily basis. I started traveling there in the late 80s, and then it was in the first Intifada. Things were much better than today, but still, in a gradual process, I saw what I saw, and gradually I changed also my views, obviously, until becoming the most hated Israeli, as the British Independent once titled me, and I carry this title with a lot of pride, I must say. I was telling all this story about myself not because I'm happy to speak about myself, but I think that the context is very important to understand the position of the Israeli people today, of my readership and those who don't read me. The Israelis, I guess some of you met Israelis in your lives. Let me tell you, they are not monsters. Some of them are very nice. Some of them are even people of values. In any catastrophe in the world, the Israeli mission will be the first one to build the first field hospital. Will it be earthquake somewhere or floods or whatever? Most of the Israelis I know would help an old lady to cross the road many times, even if she doesn't want to cross the road. They are people with values. And then you keep asking yourself, after covering the occupation for so many years and witnessing so many crimes, you ask yourself, how is it possible? How is it possible that people like the Israeli people feel so good about themselves and totally ignore the big elephant in the room, totally ignore a reality which doesn't take place overseas? It takes place, as I said, half an hour away from our homes. How come that Israelis feel not only so good about themselves, but they present humankind an unprecedented phenomenon? Never was it like this, because there were worse occupations than the Israeli occupation. There were more brutal occupations than the Israeli occupation. There were even longer occupations, even though Israel is going now for a world record. But there was never an occupation in which the occupier presents himself as the victim. This is unprecedented. The occupier was forced to occupy. The occupier is forced to maintain the occupation. If to use the unforgettable quotation of the late unforgettable Israeli Prime Minister, Mrs. Golda Meir, that you were kind enough to export to us many years ago from Milwaukee, she once said this really unbelievable sentence, which was very typical and is still valid. We will never forgive the Palestinians for forcing us to kill their children. We are the victims. You forced us to kill your children. So we are the victims. So how come that the people can live in peace with all this, with so little doubts, with so little protest, with so little resistance, in a quite open society, quite democratic society? And we'll talk about the democratic nature of Israel a little later. And I kept on asking myself, how is it possible? And there's a series of answers to this, and I think that you can't ignore none of those explanations. The first explanation that must be mentioned is that the Israelis are being brought up to believe that not only they are the victims of history, they are the biggest victims, and in many cases, the only victims in history. The Holocaust was the biggest catastrophe made by humankind, no doubt about this. But Israelis are brought up to believe that they carry this victimization that and gives them the right to do things that other people don't have the right to do because they are such victims. And again, a quotation by Golda Meir, who once said that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. It is very deep-rooted in Israeli set of values to believe that because we are such victims, we have special rights. So let's take, for example, the international law, which is extremely important, which was brought in its version after the World War II in order to prevent another Holocaust. The international law applies about any country in the world. It doesn't apply about Israel because we are different. Because we are special, because we are the victims of the Holocaust, so we have the right to ignore the international law. This is very deep-rooted in Israeli values. The second set of values, which must be analyzed in order to understand the Israeli behavior, is the very deep-rooted belief that we are the chosen people. Many Israelis who are secular wouldn't maybe admit it. But if you scratch a little bit under the skin, you will see that by the end of the day, we really believe that we are better than anyone else. We know better. We are the chosen people. And as chosen people, nobody would tell us what to do because we were chosen. And it's unbelievable how secular and obviously religious Jews believe in it and carry it into the 21st century. And the year is 2016, and Israelis still believe that we are the chosen people. This gives them, again, the right to do things that other peoples don't have the right. But that's not enough to maintain such a brutal occupation over so many years without having any moral doubts. And for this, we invented the third set of beliefs, which is quite typical to colonizers, and this is the dehumanization of the Palestinians. If the Palestinians are not equal human beings like us, then there is not really a problem of human rights. If the Palestinians are not exactly human beings like us, so we have the right to treatment as we treat them. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got, rightly so many protest letters from animal rights organizations who claimed that even animals deserve more, and they were right. I always bring up this example, which freaks out Israelis, but it's a real example, in which one of the wars in Gaza, there were two Israeli dogs killed, one in an operation in Gaza, a dog who accompanied the combats, and one dog was killed by a Qassam rocket in Sderot, which is on the border with Gaza. Both dogs got front page coverage in Israeli media with their photos, with their owners mourning, with their names, with people telling about their courage, about their devotion, about how beautiful and well-educated they were, including some tears of soldiers over their graves. In the very same days that those two dogs were killed, there were tens of Palestinians killed on a daily basis. It was war in Gaza. And the coverage of those tens and hundreds and thousands and tens of thousands of Palestinians is never like the coverage of those two Israeli dogs. No names, nothing which reminds you that they are human beings. The coverage in the Israeli media, which is a free media, is always a dehumanizing coverage, showing only the terrorists, calling them the terrorists, never showing their human side, never reminding the Israeli consumer that we are dealing with human beings and even equal human beings, and doing anything possible to maintain this feeling that whatever we are doing is right because they are not equal human beings. Not to speak about them as not having the equal rights on this piece of land, but I don't go so far, for sure, about equal rights, that's out of the question. But first of all, even not to perceive them as human rights equal to us. They have no problems to send their children to be killed. They were born to kill. They have no emotions. They are not human. They are cruel. They are barbaric. And this is being said by people who never met a Palestinian, who had never visited a mourning house of a Palestinian family who lost their children or their other relatives. I am doing so in the last 30 years, and I can tell you here with full responsibility, I know it is sensational for some Israelis, but the Palestinians are equal human rights to us, with the same emotions, the same needs, the same dreams, and many times the same set of values, and in many times even better values. So the Israelis had construct themselves a world of their own, and this is also to enable to continue to live in peace with the reality of the occupation. And this world includes all kinds of totally disconnected phenomena. I mean, disconnected behavior. You know, many times people who are disconnected with reality need some help, need some therapy. In worst cases, they must be sent to hospitalization. But in most cases, drugs can do it. But people who are disconnected with reality have a problem. And if Israelis deeply believe that 6 million Jews in Israel are right, and so many billions of people in the world are wrong, this shows that there is a problem. There is not one single issue in the international arena today which unites the entire world, from China to Russia, from the United States to Africa, from Europe to Australia. Not one single state recognized the Israeli occupation. Not one single state recognized the settlements project, even not Micronesia, which used to be Israel's second ally. And Israelis think that it is normal like this, that the fact that the entire world sees something in a different way tells something about the world, not about us. Because according to Israel perceptions, anybody who dares to criticize Israel, is by definition anti-Semitic. You know it, I guess, part of you. Don't you dare to criticize Israel, because any criticism is anti-Semitism. That's a very efficient way to shut mouths, to make the critic the one who should apologize, to make the critic the one who is responsible for immorality, and the one who is criticized becomes the one who blames. It's not our responsibility, it's yours. You're anti-Semitic, we are wonderful. This is very efficient, mainly in Europe, which carries its guilt feelings and heritage. And by this, Israelis created a situation in which the whole world is against us. The world is hating us. And therefore, it doesn't matter what we do, because the world will hate us in any case. So let's ignore the world. When 90 heads of states are coming to a funeral in Jerusalem, one should ask, where is anti-Semitism all of a sudden? Where is this hatred? How many other politicians would have got such a funeral with top leaders from the entire world like Shimon Peres did? But the belief that we are hated, the belief that it doesn't matter what we will do, the world will hate us, is again a factor to continue the status quo and to ignore anything else. And here I come to the relations with your beloved country, with the biggest ally of Israel, the United States. Many times people watch these relations and they ask, who is the superpower between the two? Who is blackmailing whom here? Who is supplying whom with money and weapons? And I must tell you, frankly, that if there is something which I don't understand, never understood, and most probably never will understand, is the basis of this sick relations. And I can't call it but sick relations. Because, you know, if you have a relative or a friend who is a drug addict, you have two ways to treat him. You might supply him with money, he will buy more drugs. He will be very grateful, he will like you, but will it be love, will it be care? Not at all. The other way is to send him to a rehabilitation center. He will hate you for this, but isn't this more love and care and affection and true friendship? What happens between the United States and Israel is far beyond my understanding. Maybe you would be able to explain it to me. But I know one thing, that Israel was never so dependent on the United States, militarily, politically, economically. And the United States had never done so little to use this dependence for constructive purposes. I will try to claim here tonight that the moment that there will be an American president who will really want to put an end to the occupation will end within months, not more than months. The moment that there will be an American president who will be devoted to bring justice, this moment justice will happen, because Israel cannot do anything without the United States. But what we are witnessing is the opposite. An Israeli prime minister who dares, who allows himself to do things that no other leader in the world would dare. Neither the prime minister of the UK nor the chancellor of Germany would ever dare to treat an American president like the Israeli prime minister did. No ambassador would dare to go to the Congress and to try to convince congressmen against the administration, against the government, against the president. And America accepted it. Israel was spitting at America, and America said, no, it's rain. And this happens under the most promising American president ever. I had tears in my eyes, if I may be personal, on the night in which Barack Obama was elected. I had no doubts that his heart is in the right place, that he knows one or two things about justice, about black slavery in this country, about human rights. I even so that he might make the comparison between the black slavery and the fate of the Palestinian people under the Israeli occupation. And I was sure that we are going for a real revolutionary period with a revolutionary change. And now, 8 years later, and George W. Bush did more for peace in the Middle East than Barack Obama. Can you believe that I say this sentence? Can I believe that I can say this sentence? But that's the truth. A total failure, which is not only a failure for now, it is for the long run. Because Barack Obama taught the Israelis that they can do whatever they want. They will not pay for anything. They can attack Gaza one time after the other and nothing will happen. They can build settlements as much as they wish, and except of this empty lip service of the State Department announcement telling that the United States doesn't like the developments, which Israel learned to totally ignore, but who cares about this lip service? The America of the last 8 years, more than any other time, taught Israel that they have a free check, an open check. I still remember times when even Ariel Sharon, who was such a powerful prime minister, was so scared from what the Americans will say. The other day, his aide told me that the days that Condoleezza Rice would call him, he would usually get an announcement 24 hours before, tomorrow at 4 o'clock, Condoleezza Rice is going to call you. He would not sleep the whole night out of fear what will be in this phone call. What will she tell him? And now we have a prime minister who couldn't care less about what the American administration will tell him. And rightly so, rightly so. Barack Obama signs an open check for Israel for the coming 10 years, $38 billion, $300 from each of you taxpayers, American taxpayers. What for? What for? Is Israel the first place in the world that needs the money? Does the Israeli army, isn't it the most well-equipped army in the world? Who does the Israeli army face exactly now? What army face us exactly? What kind of dangers? Most of the job of the Israeli army in the recent decades is to run after children with stones, to kill young men and women with knives. For this, you don't need 5 submarines. For this, you don't need F-35. Most of its job is today maintaining the occupation. It's an occupying army with some other dangers like Iran, which I wouldn't ignore, I shouldn't ignore, and some others, but proportion. Why does Israel need this money? And if you decide to donate this money for your own reasons, which I don't know why not to use this money for constructive purposes? Why not to push Israel for doing some kind of positive steps to put an end to this occupation? But I don't have answers to those questions. Maybe you have. The fact is that this government, who treated the American administration as they did, got the biggest sum of money ever with a guarantee for 10 years without any visible reason. I can't even see it serving the American interests, not to speak about values, but let's put aside values. What about interests? What interest does it serve? They always say that we, Israel, we are in the front, we are the airplanes carrier of the United States in the Middle East. Fine. But on this airplanes carrier are taking place all kinds of crimes and atrocities on a daily basis. So can't you handle what's going on your own airplane carrier? Can you really agree that this reality will continue?
You're listening to Gideon Levy, The Never-Ending Occupation, Palestine. This is Alternative Radio, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. You can order copies of today's program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
And we are celebrating now 50 years next year for the Israeli occupation. And it's a nice reminder for all of us that this occupation is here to stay, that nobody in Israel has a real intention to put an end to it, that this temporary phenomena became reality and for many, many years. If there was hope once, which I didn't share, that Israel is about to give up the occupation, after 50 years, one can realize that Israel has no intention and, may I say, never had an intention to put an end to the occupation. Why not? Because Israel can maintain the occupation without paying any price. Because Israelis can live with the occupation without paying any price. And as long as this will continue, the occupation will continue. And here I come to the role of the international community. One could understand already that I have very little expectation from a change from within Israeli society, a society which is so brainwashed, which knows so little and wishes to know so little, whose values are so biased. There is no way that there will be change coming out of this Israeli society. We have very devoted Israeli groups and individuals which are really adorable, and they are devoted, and they are courageous, and they go to demonstrate, and they go to fight, but they are very small in numbers, and they are totally delegitimized in Israeli public opinion, and they will not bring a change. I say it with a lot of pain, but they will not bring a change, because change will not come from within Israeli society as long as Israelis live in peace with the occupation. Why would they bother? Why would they bother? Why would an Israeli bother about the occupation? Why? No reason. Life in Tel Aviv is so wonderful. Why would you bother about what's going on half an hour away from your home when you hardly know what's going on there? So thinking that there's no hope from within the Israeli society, the only hope which is left is from the international community. That's the only hope. And whatever worked efficiently with apartheid system in South Africa should be working also with Israel. Now, people say in Israel, boycott is not a moral tool. Excuse me? Doesn't Israel use boycott as a tool? Didn't we call the world to put sanctions on Iran? Doesn't Israel boycott Hamas regime in Gaza? Don't we put a total siege on Gaza, the biggest cage in the world? So, boycott is a legitimate tool. It is a non-violent tool. And it might be a very effective tool. It might be, not necessarily. There are no guarantees. But as I see today, and it's not easy for me to stand here and to say it as an Israeli who lives in Israel, who doesn't boycott Israel, because I live there. But I can tell you that right now, BDS is almost the only game in town. When you see governments from all over the world continue to support Israel, continue to support the occupation project, continue to support depression of the Palestinian people, then the only hope is from civil societies. That's the last hope. And civil societies can make the difference. And civil society did make the difference in the past, because we are dealing, at least in the West, with democracies, which by the end of the day public opinion will affect the governments. So for me, as I'm so skeptical about change from within, the only hope is change from the outside. But that's very nice. The question is, what do we want to happen? Things seem from here very simple, but things are not so simple, even though I'm one of those who think that the so-called conflict between the Israelis and Palestinians, I'm not sure that's the right way to call it, because there was no conflict between France and Algeria. There was a French occupation of Algeria, and there is an Israeli occupation of Palestine. But let's call it as people do call it, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. What solutions are on the table? For many years, I was a great believer of the two-state solution. It makes sense. It is the most logical solution. Two peoples share one piece of land. Let's split the land. Makes sense. In any case, there will never be total justice. So we are dealing with relative justice, because the Palestinians who lost their land, part of them lost it forever. We will not create new justice by new injustice. We will not send all the Jews back to Europe, because this will create new injustice and new refugees, and this doesn't make sense. We have to share it. But sharing the land, as simple as it sounds, was for many years the best solution. The only problem is that Israel had no intention to do so. Not only this, while we were thinking that we are living in a status quo, Israel was never in a status quo, because Israel never stopped building settlements, which is the biggest violation of the status quo. You know, whenever Netanyahu comes up and says he's ready to start negotiations without preconditions, what about the settlements? That's the mother and father of preconditions. Because this reality might become, and as we like to say it, on the ground, there is an irreversible reality. 600,000 to 700,000 settlers are almost impossible, in my view, impossible to be removed. Without their removal, there is no viable Palestinian state. I don't buy all those explanations of those experts who can tell you, like a piece of Swiss cheese with all the holes, we will make a Palestinian state with all the settlements staying here and there and the blacks. And no. The Palestinian people lost in 48 its land. We are dealing now with around 28% of what is left from their original land. This must be theirs, at least the 28%. We can't start to bargain now about the left 28% and start to say some settlements will remain and you will get some compensation. It will not work without evacuating of all the settlements. And I must remind you that the settlement project, which is, as I said, not recognized by any country in the world, including the United States, the settlement project was born in order to prevent any kind of settlement with the Palestinians. This was the original goal, and this goal was achieved, and we have to admit it. Nobody will evacuate 600,000 to 700,000 settlers. There is no Israeli politician who will be able to do so. And if so, and if the two-state solution is dead, we have to start to ask ourselves what is left. I think that the train left the station. Many people tell me that not yet, that it's now injury times, as we call it in soccer. In any case, we are not moving toward anywhere, so you want to wait another year and then declare the death of the two-state solution. You may wait, but I don't know what can happen in this year, because the settlements are being built. There is no intention from Israel to go to any kind of serious negotiations. So when will it be declared dead? But then we have to ask ourselves, what is the alternative? And there is only one alternative, if we like it or if we don't like it. And this is the one-state solution. Now, before we start to scream, because Israelis get shocked when you speak about the one-state solution, it's far beyond the legitimate borders of discourse in Israel, I must remind every one of us that we are living in a one state for the last 50 years. It is a one state. And the only problem is the regime of this state. It is a wonderful liberal democracy in the front and one of the most brutal regimes on earth in the backyard. And when I say one of the most brutal regimes on earth, I mean it. Take my word, after 30 years of coverage of the Israeli occupation, it is one of the most brutal, violent, and cruel regimes on earth. Life, daily life, under the Israeli occupation is nothing that any of us can imagine. From the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, and much after you went to sleep. In more peaceful times, and especially in more violent times, but always the routine is of depression, of soldiers coming into your home in the middle of the night, breaking the door, entering the house, destroying half of it, waking up, arresting without any legal basis, of checkpoints, of administrative detentions, which is a nice way to call detentions without any trial, without any procedure, legal procedure, hundreds and thousands. It's a reality of not knowing what will be tomorrow. It's a reality of Gaza, which is, as I said before, the biggest prison on earth. It's the reality of not being able to get to work, to get to a hospital, to get to relatives. It's a reality in which your life is in danger and your life is worth nothing. In the last year, this year of the so-called knife intifada, so many young Palestinians were killed for nothing. Yes, part of them had scissors in their hands. Other parts of them had knives in their hands, yes. Part of them did try to stab soldiers or settlers, yes. And still, they were executed. Because most of them, not all of them, most of them could have been easily arrested. In the worst case, they could shoot their legs, but no, they chose to shoot them dead, and they were perceived as heroes. Now, if anyone thinks that a soldier of 18 who is being trained to kill any young man, boy, or girl with a knife in his hand is the only way to stop him, if you think that 10 years later and 20 years later, when he will move back to Israel, he will forget what he was taught and he will behave according to different moral values, he's damn wrong. And this will finally also destroy the Israeli society from within. But I don't want to go to this direction because the real victims are the Palestinians, not the Israelis. And the Palestinians are going through, really, I guess part of you know about it, and I will not get into individual stories which I follow week after week, but believe me, my heart breaks week after week out of pain, out of shame, because it's on my behalf. And it is like this, and it cannot be different, because as long as this occupation continues, it cannot be different. So, are we willing that this reality will last forever in the 21st century? Are we willing that the last remain of Western colonialism will continue like this, with the support and the financing of the United States, with the support and the financing of the European Union? Are we ready for this? It is a possibility. If the world will not say its word, the occupation will continue for many more years. Why not? Why not? If nobody will push to put an end to it, it will continue. and it will be generation after generation of Palestinians which will be born into this reality. There will be resistance, there will be bloodshed, Israel will always be stronger, and it might continue for many, many more years. The other way is to put an end to it. If we realize that the two-state solution is a train that left the station, the discourse must start from now on to be equal rights. No Israeli can give a fair justification for not giving equal rights to the Palestinians. It's not about security, it's not about the Holocaust, it's not about anything. Equal rights. And I want to hear the Israeli answer. Why not? Because we are the chosen people? Okay, so then we call it officially an apartheid state. Because if two people share one piece of land, and one people gets all the rights in the world and the other people doesn't get any right in the world, it looks like apartheid, it behaves like apartheid, it talks like apartheid, and it is apartheid. And when it becomes not a temporary phenomena but a permanent reality, the world has to say its word about it, as it did about South Africa. The world was not indifferent about South Africa. Why would it be indifferent about Israel? So if we start to talk, and it's a long way to go, and to believe that a one-state solution is an easy formula in which Palestinians and Israelis will fall on the shoulders of the others and love and make love and not war, and everything will be so wonderful, I mean, that's an illusion. I know it. I just know that there is no other way. The only way is now one of two. It will be one state. The question if it will be a democratic state or it will be an apartheid state. That's the only question which is still open. All the other questions, unfortunately, according to my view, are gone, are not relevant, are not on the table anymore. And what is more just than to ask for equal rights? What is more moral than to ask for equal rights? Like black people ask in this country, Palestinians and the moral world and the liberal world should insist on it, equal rights. And if Israelis will tell you, but that's the end of Zionism, that's the end of the Jewish state, there will be a Palestinian majority, or it will be equal. Right now it's equal. Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and Israel and Jews are right now 50-50. It's around 6 million Jews and 6 million Palestinians, including Gaza, which cannot be ignored, by the way, in any solution, because there is the tendency to say, okay, Gaza we'll put aside. No, Gaza is part of the Palestinian problem. But in any case, what will the Israelis say? It's the end of Zionism? Where have you been until now? Would you like a Jewish state? Be my guest. But then you can't stay in the occupied territories. You can't have it both. Israelis love to eat the cake and leave it complete. We had once a very famous advertisement for brass, go with and feel without. Israelis love to go with the occupation and feel without it, but this is this connection of reality. And Israelis cannot have it both. Those who want a Jewish state, I couldn't care less about it, but I totally respect those who want a Jewish state. I never get an answer, what does it mean, a Jewish state, but they say that they know, fine with them. Is it a religious state? Is it a secular state? What are Jewish values? I know only universal values. I don't know Jewish values. But, you know, whatever you don't know, you don't know. You say, fine, Jewish state, Jewish values, everything is fine. But you can't have it both. Then it must be a state with a Jewish majority. It cannot include the occupied territories. But if you want the territories, then it must be a democracy. It can't go both. Don't believe the Israel Zionistic left, my friends in the Zionistic left who tell you that Israel can be Jewish and Zionistic and democratic. It's either Jewish or democratic. Because once it is Jewish in its borders now, once it is a Jewish state, it gives privileges to one people on the other people. This has nothing to do with democracy. As simple as this. And if it is a democratic state, then there is no privileges to any people, and then, you know, each community will live its life. Equal rights is the only game left, must be the only slogan to accompany a new struggle, because I have a suspicion that those of us, and there are many, who still speak about two-state solution, from the American administration to even Benjamin Netanyahu, a big supporter of the two-state solution. All those supporters of the two-state solution never meant it, don't mean it, and they use it only to gain more time in order to establish the occupation even more, to build more settlements, and to really present the world an irreversible reality. But the two-state solution, in my view, is dead, and the only game in town is equal rights. Is it? Thank you. But still, reality, as pessimistic as it is, I have to conclude my opening remarks with a source of hope. And there are only two sources of hopes, which are not very strong, I admit, but that's the maximum I can provide tonight. One is that if we all would have met in the late 80s, and I would have told you that within months, Soviet Russia is going to collapse, apartheid system in South Africa is going to collapse, and the Berlin Wall is going to fall. Nobody had foreseen this. Nobody. And it happened, even without bloodshed. So many times in history, the unexpected happens without any signs. Many times you have those beautiful trees here in Santa Fe. Many times you see a tree falls, and you don't know how come he looks so strong, so healthy, and he falls. And then you look inside it, and you see how rotten it was. Is there anything more rotten than the Israeli occupation? So by the end of the day, there is hope that things will happen in times that we don't expect them. And if this is not enough for you to come out with some kind of hope, the last card that I have in my pocket, the last rabbit that I can send to the air, is the deep belief that, at least in the Middle East, one should be realistic enough to believe in miracles. And we need some miracles. Thank you very much.
That was Gideon Levy, The Never-Ending Occupation, Palestine. He spoke in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Gideon Levy was born and lives in Tel Aviv. He's an award-winning columnist and member of the editorial board of Haaretz, Israel's oldest daily newspaper, where he has covered the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for more than 30 years. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 30 years of independent broadcasting. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the corporate-controlled media, such as Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, Naomi Klein, Max Blumenthal, Bill McKibben, Chris Hedges, and Vandana Shiva. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Gideon Levy on the Never-Ending Occupation, Palestine, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Special thanks to Barbara Ventrello and the Lannan Foundation. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.